Hi, everybody. My name's Ruth F. And I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, an adult child of an alcoholic, and a member of Al-Anon. And I'm really, really grateful to be here today. Really grateful to be here today. I really feel like this is family. I just do. It's sometimes just, I mean, I feel like I know you, and I do know you. I mean, we're so much the same in so many ways. And when I was here 4 years ago, it's amazing to have an opportunity to contrast ourselves and to see how things are different. I was surprised when I got the call. I have to share this with you. I was surprised when I got the call to speak this year because I thought that I had, 4 years ago when I came, I was having a great deal of difficulty with my father. I had been born in Boston. I was born in Boston, but I was brought up in Detroit from the time I was 2.5 to 10. And I had a lot of healing that had not yet happened with my father. So when I was here 4 years ago, I remember talking and talking and talking about my father and the stuff that was going on still within me around my father. And I remember when I finished speaking, I thought, boy, I went on much too long and I talked about my father much too much. And I just, that isn't what they wanted me there for. And I'm sure I had done a terrible job. So when I got a call this time, I thought, oh, you can never judge yourself. You really can't. They invited me back. Isn't that wonderful? And I was thrilled to be able to come back. Because maybe I can talk about something else other than my father this time. But my memories of being here as a kid, and I'm supposed to be a spiritual speaker, and I'm not even sure I want to say what the word spirituality really even is. It's been such a process for me of growing in what I think spirituality is. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but spirituality is a very vague thing. I think it's individual to all of us. But thinking about that as a, quote, spiritual speaker, I remembered my time here in Detroit when I was a kid. We had moved here. My father had lost a jewelry business in the Depression, and he struggled for the rest of his life. He's going to be 94 in June. He's still alive. But he struggled for the rest of his life to find himself. And at the time, he came here because he had a job opportunity. At that time, the movies were giving out dishes. And I think that's what he was doing. And he was also a traveling salesman. He did some clothing. He sold some clothes. But we were very, very happy here. And he, at that time, had not reached any difficulty with alcoholism. So that we had a good relationship in the years that I was here. And I remember he took me to Belle Isle and we flew kites. I'm not quite sure where we did things. But the happy times were Sundays when my mother would stay home and traditionally cook the Sunday dinner. My father would take me out on Sunday mornings and go kite flying and pony riding. And I remember we did something where he took me in a little cart and a pony pulled us. And he gave me the love of nature, and he gave me the love of sports. I was very, very athletic, and I loved sports, and he gave me the love of outdoors. And we had a wonderful relationship in those years. And then we moved back to Boston. I'll get my age now, too. We moved back to Boston at the end of the war in 45 when I was 10. Not quite 10. I was going to be 10 in October, so I don't want you to think I'm that old, right? But then my life changed. I remember being free here. I remember going to school and going over fences and neighbors' backyards and taking lilacs from people and bringing them to my teacher. I don't know. I just remember being a real free, happy kid without worries. It was during the war, and we would even put on skits in the backyard and sing and charge the neighbors a nickel or something, you know, and the kids would sing. And I didn't have a voice, and I could do that and not even worry that I didn't have a voice. What I think it was then is I didn't worry what will people think of me. I think this was before all that happened. And it's an incredible time to remember. But then we moved back to Boston. My father had lost the job or the jobs. We had to live with a very rich relative in Newton, Massachusetts. That was a very wealthy place at the time. And then we moved and lived with another relative. This was all in the fifth grade. I moved three different times. And then we moved to Brookline, where everybody in Brookline had money but us. And my mother spent extra money to send me to a school where other Jewish kids were, because we lived near an area where there was mostly non-Jewish kids, and my mother wanted me to be exposed to rich Jewish kids so someday I would marry a rich Jewish husband. This is a kid, you know, I'm in the fifth grade or something like that. But this was her goal, because at that time, and I don't think that that was at all unusual at that time, that's the goal for girls. And, you know, you get married and you have kids and somebody takes care of you and you're happy if this person has money. So I got the message right away when I was playing in my backyard with my baseball bat and my baseball glove, and when I wore jeans with my shirt out and I was happy, you know, I was happy like I was in Detroit. The immediate message I got was, why don't you wear a dress like Elise, and why don't you have your hair curled like Margie, you know, the kids across the street. So my immediate message was that I'm not as good as them, or my mother wants me to be different. And the gal that spoke Friday night talked a lot about not being good enough. And that was my message right from that time, that they're better than you, why can't you be more like them? And on top of that, I loved sports. And the kids that liked sports were the Irish kids in my school. There were about three or four Irish kids in my school. My mother had spent this extra $150 to send me to this school where Jewish kids were. And the kids I'm bringing home, I'll never forget it, were Janet O'Brien and somebody else. And these were, you know, these were the kids that I connected with, because they were the kids that liked the same things I did. So even my friends weren't good enough. Naturally, my friends weren't good enough. My selections weren't good enough. My choices weren't good enough. What I wore wasn't good enough. What I liked wasn't good enough. And in my heart, I still loved the same things. So I would take my bicycle, and I would go to this beautiful place in Brookline where they had a tree trunk out over a pond. And I would sit, and I would paint, and I would write, and I'd be very, very happy there. And I'd go alone. And my mother would tell me there's something wrong with me because I was alone. You know, I did things alone. And we had an apartment, and I'd go on top of the roof and paint. And again, what's wrong with you? Why can't you be with the kids? So these contradictory messages. I mean, what was in my heart, and now I know my spirit, that was my true spirit, and connecting that with my spiritual life, that's when I was connected with God, with nature, was told was not right. And that which didn't feel comfortable to me, I was told I should do. That's what other people did, I should do. Well, over the years, my complexes, I guess, developed. In hindsight, I know that my mother only wanted the best for me. I truly know that. And I loved my mother very dearly. And I truly know that her life was very unhappy, with more so as my father became more and more alcoholic. But her life was very unhappy. And what she wanted for my brother and I was happiness. And this truly was how she thought. That we could be happy. So I really don't have resentments at all against my mother, because she gave us a great deal of love and a great deal of support. And she really did love and honor me, in that she would send me to art classes, and she would, you know, make sure that I had the things I loved and the things I needed. But her view still was them out there, and what will the neighbors think, and trying to be more like them. At any rate, over the years, things really got worse inside of me, and my inferiority complexes got so strong that my mother had actually gone to camp so that my brother and I could be at camp. My mother became a camp secretary because all the kids in the neighborhood were rich enough to go to camp, and she couldn't afford to send us to camp. So she went to work at this camp so that my brother and I could go. And at one point in high school, they had two groups in high school that was an honor if you were asked to join. And I was invited into one of the groups, the Curry Club. And I remember thinking, this gal had invited me into the group to join. And she had come to camp. She had gone to the same camp. And I remember thinking, she never would have invited me if she didn't know my mother at camp. Now, somehow, I thought so little of myself that I couldn't give myself enough credit to be invited in because of who I am. And I had to figure a way, why would they have ever invited me in? I'm not like them at all. It must be that she wanted my mother to like her. Now, in looking at this later, and many, many years later, that's real twisted thinking. But my thinking was twisted. My self-esteem was so low. But that's how I thought in those days. They wouldn't like me for me. There must be another reason. And somewhere in there, around 16, a few different things happened. Number one, I found alcohol, and I found that that was the only time that I could feel comfortable, the only time that I could feel relaxed, the only time that I would let go of this huge inhibitions and I could dance. And then I also started finding out that something was wrong with me, which I thought something was wrong with me, because all my friends were dating, and they were enjoying dating. And I was dating a lot, too. I dated a lot. And the guys were just like brothers to me. I had no interest in anybody. And I didn't put anything together for many, many years. I put nothing together for many, many years. I just thought, well, there's something missing in me. And I continued to date and continued not to find anybody. And I continued to date. And my mother would say, why don't you go out with somebody more than once or twice? And I would say, you know, they're nice guys, but... and she'd say, how will you know if you don't go out more? And I just had no interest. And I didn't know anything. I honestly didn't know anything. It's like the dark ages when I look back. So I went on to college, started a greeting card business in college, met a guy, continued to drink, and my drinking got more and more. I was even in a sorority. I was popular. I dated a lot. I was well-liked. I still didn't like me inside, except if I drank. And at the end of my senior year, we had made a pact with a group of people, a group of friends, that we would all have at least one drink between 37 days before graduation and graduation. And I remember the group got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, but two of us lasted. And we made the 37 days of having at least a drink that day. I was drunk a lot. I had a wonderful time with alcohol. I took pride that I could drink anybody under the table. You know, it was really... It was something, boy, I could do. It was wonderful. And, you know, looking back, I still love the idea of the taste of scotch. I can think of it now, and I can still like it. It just really, well, you know. But I started this greeting card business at the end of college and did meet a guy that at the time I thought, well, we have 95% things in common. At the end of the marriage, I figured it was really 5%. But we liked to ski. He liked to ski. We played bridge. We did a lot. He liked sports. And he drank with me while we got engaged. He'll probably never hear this tape. I knew I didn't love him, but I figured it was as close as I would get to somebody that I could marry. We had a lot of fun together. And at any rate, my drinking continued. We drank a lot during our dating, and then my drinking continued. We got married, and he stopped drinking at that point. And he said it made him tired. Can you imagine? His drinking made him tired. And I continued my drinking on a daily basis. I was a daily drinker by then. And I would stay in the kitchen, and I'd say, supper isn't ready yet, you know, so that I could pour another and another. By then, I had this continual glass. It was like always at a certain level, so that he would never know that I didn't just... He never saw it empty, so he'd think I was just still sipping on the same glass of scotch. And the years went by, and somewhere inside of me, I knew that I was having trouble. And somewhere inside of me, I knew that I was afraid to go a day without a drink. And I knew I drank differently than other people. There was... And I knew... I needed it on a daily basis, on a level that I wasn't even ready to ever talk about with anybody, because if I talked about it, somebody might want to do something about it, really. And I didn't want to put the words out. It's like now when it's the same thing now. If I know that I have something to change, I don't want to talk about it till I'm really ready to change. Well, that's the way it was then, and I continued to hide and get more bottles in the house and hide them. And I started the whole process of the trouble of getting rid of empties and the struggle of spending the money that we didn't have and charging and taking away from other things, manipulating money and manipulating my life around alcohol. I had three children during these years. In the first two pregnancies, somewhere inside of me, I knew to stop drinking. And I was able to stop. That was the only time I stopped drinking during my drinking years. When I was about 2.5 months pregnant with my first daughter, I remember pouring a glass of scotch out and not having it again until I came home from the hospital after she was born. Same with the second. And by the time my third child was born, my daughter, I had come to con myself enough to be in denial enough to say it didn't matter because I really drank those first 2.5, you know, months of the first pregnancy, so it's not going to matter if I continue to drink now. And she's fine today, and she's 29 this year. But when she was born 7 weeks early. There was a 50-50 chance as to whether she would live or not. And I remember not wanting to ask the doctor, did my drinking have anything to do with it? We had played poker the night before, and two neighbors and myself had consumed 2.5 quarts of scotch, I remember. And then my water broke the next morning, and she was born. And I remember carrying this with me, so scared that something would be wrong. And thank God she's fine. But that's where my drinking was by then. And I still had a lot of time to go before I was going to get any help. My drinking got worse and worse. My life depended, my daily life depended around my drinking. I couldn't imagine living without it, and I couldn't imagine living with it any longer. And the last 5 years of my drinking were mainly trying to stop every day. Okay, I tried to stop drinking every day. I'd say today's the last day of my drinking, and I would not have anything in the house because I would have finished it the night before. I had my own business, so I would drive to work, but the way I worked is I'd always be home for the kids when I came home from school, so I would come home by 3:30. So my car would pull into a package store at 3:30, and I'd say, I'm not going to drink today, and I would only get a pint, and then I'd get another pint before the package store closed at night. I was constantly struggling with not drinking. I came to a place where I totally hated myself, really. I thought I was a terrible mother, a terrible wife. I'm a terrible person, and I couldn't figure it out. I figured that other people knew how to live, and I did not have a clue. I didn't know what anything was all about. I had no idea why I felt so empty, why I felt so nothing, why I felt so nothing, I guess, really. I had no clue at all. And after different instances, such as probably one of the most profound ones was that a TV had fallen and my daughter got a cut in her head. And I remember we had to take her to the hospital, and I was drunk. And I remember not wanting to talk to the doctor because I didn't want to open my mouth because I didn't want the smell of the booze to just pour out on him, and I was so ashamed. I remember not even saying anything to this doctor to ask any of the questions that I wanted to ask because I was just so ashamed. I was such a terrible mother. And another time, my ex-husband was out of town, and my son had a very, very high temperature. And I had to take him to the doctor again, as it was. He had 100 and 304, and I remember driving so carefully. It was 2:30 in the afternoon, and I was already high. And I remember driving so carefully and so ashamed, driving him to this doctor to find out what was wrong. And an important thing happened here. That same time, my car was stolen and my glasses were run over by a truck and that in that same week. And I remember my husband called on the phone and I told him these three things and he laughed. I'll never forget that. And when he came home, I said, how could you have laughed when I told you these three, you know, really, really serious things? And he said, because I knew you'd handle it. And I was still, didn't know it, but I was still putting it out there that Ruth could handle anything. Ruth could do anything. I was still covering up all the stuff that was going on inside of me to the point where my husband said, you could handle it. It was no big deal. My father told me I could handle anything. Ruth could do anything. No matter, he always told the story to my brother that of myself climbing up the hill. He took me to a place to go skiing, and I would climb up the hill and ski down and fall, but I'd pick myself up and climb up again and ski down and fall, and etc. I'd keep on picking myself up. So he always told the story, Ruth can do anything. All you have to do is want to do it bad enough and you can do anything. And I really got that message, but I could not stop drinking. And finally, I guess when I hated myself enough, I had called AA a number of times in those last 5 years. My father's drinking had gotten much worse, and I actually called them with the pretense that I was calling for my father. My father had come out to the house every Sunday, and he'd bring a bottle of scotch with him because he could get it wholesale. Jewish people can do that. But I remember always hiding the other bottle that I had in the house because I used to think, it's not good for him. I don't want him to have too much to drink. And truthfully, of course, I'd be hiding it so that I'd have more when he left. But I'd call IA and say, my father has a problem. And they told me, they gave me information about where meetings were. I went to the big book, and I went to the library, and I got the big book, and I remember it said God. And I returned it. I wanted no part of it at all. But finally, I guess I came to the place, grace of God, that I could not live the way I was living any longer. I truly couldn't. There was nothing in my life other than hating the way I was and yet not knowing how I could possibly live without drinking. And I finally, I had gone to a psychiatrist a couple of years earlier. I remember speaking to my gynecologist, my obstetrician, and earlier when I was pregnant and telling him that I thought I might have a problem. He was the only person I ever did tell that I might have a problem. And he said, don't worry, even alcoholics have normal babies. And they didn't know what they know today. And he didn't know what he was saying to me. But I had this picture. That was the first time I think I ever heard the word alcoholic. And I had this picture of somebody with a long black dress shuffling along. I don't know where I even got the image, but that was my picture. And he had said, call me when you're ready to do something about it. And finally I did at one point, and he gave me the name of a psychiatrist who said, there's nothing wrong with you, just a few visits will help and a few pills. 2.5 years later, I had been on something like 32 different kinds of pills because this man was committed to helping me even though he knew nothing about alcoholism. So if one pill didn't work, you know, here's another. In fact, I was taking so many pills that I was shaking, and he said, take Artane. It's an anti-shake pill. I remember that. That's a resentment I've had to really work on, that man. But finally, after 2.5 years of the psychiatrist, too, I finally came to a place where I had a very dear friend who was my secretary artist in the greeting card business. And I had asked her to come over the house one afternoon. And I had a bottle of scotch in the closet of my bedroom. And she came over, and I remember it was 2:30 in the afternoon, and I told her the truth. For the very first time, I had told somebody really the truth, that I really couldn't stop drinking. I was really afraid of what it was doing to my life. I didn't know what to do. And she called AA. I can picture her today. She got the telephone, and she called AA and said, you have to do something to help this girl. And she handed me the phone, and I shook my head. And I wouldn't take the receiver. And they said to her something very, very profound that I'll never, never forget. They said, we can't do anything for her until she's ready to help herself. And I excused myself from Rosalie, and I said, I'll be right back, because that bottle of scotch was calling me in the bedroom. And I brought it out, and I tried to be very relaxed and normal, as if, you know, this is just a normal thing to do at 2:30 in the afternoon after all that I've been telling her. And I poured a glass of scotch, and she looked at me, and she said, I cannot stay here and watch you kill yourself. And she walked out of my house. And that was very powerful, because she was the only person I trusted, the only person I had talked to. And she left. And that was a Tuesday. And I remember promising myself I wouldn't drink on Wednesday. And I didn't. I went one day without drinking. But by Thursday, I was drinking again. And I did go to AA. And that was in January of 1973. And that was incredible. Because I was dirty. I remember I was just dirty and grubby. And I had thought that I had hit this horrible, horrible bottom, that it was the worst place that I was going. And I had been told to speak to a secretary when I went in, and I did. I introduced myself as somebody new. And she had six women surround me right away. And people just reached out. And it was so incredible because I knew I was home. It was for the very first time in my life. I was 37 years old. And for the very first time in my life, I was with people who understood me. People who had been where I had been. You knew me. And I knew that I was home. And I knew I had found what I've been looking for all my life. And I had no idea yet what it was that I had found, but I just knew. My heart knew. You know, it was the first time. My heart just opened, I guess, for the first time. And I was home. And I didn't stop drinking right away. I'd put 2 weeks together, I'd drink. I'd put 3 weeks together, I'd drink. I kept on saying, still, next time it'll be different. I didn't totally want to give it up yet, but it grew on me. And you told me to ask for help, and I didn't believe in God. My father had told me Ruth could do anything, and I still believed that. Even though I knew I couldn't stop drinking, I really thought that God was for the weak, that God was some religious thing that was for the weak, and that I would be weak if I prayed. But each time I picked up another drink, it got worse inside of me. And finally, I was able to ask for help to a God I didn't believe in, and I said, if you're up there, it doesn't matter. And if you're up there, you'll understand it. If you're not, it doesn't matter. But please keep me away from one drink and the desire for a drink for one day and a pill and a desire for a pill. And it worked. I mean, this incredible thing worked. It was like, my God, it can't be working. I mean, it can't be. I must, you know, whatever. It worked. It was incredible. And gradually, I was able to put a few days together, and gradually I was, and I did get into steps right away. And the part of the story that I don't usually tell, because usually when you speak, you have 20 minutes, and usually I speak at straight meetings. But the part of the story I don't usually tell, happened really early in sobriety. Because what I didn't know about me, and truly didn't know about me, something very, very scary started happening for me. And it was scary. I started getting attracted to women. And it was horrible. It was really horrible and scary. Because I thought for sure something's wrong with me now. See, I really didn't know anything. I was this naive kid. In my growing up, we never talked about anything. I didn't know anything. My husband and I had actually gone to Provincetown, you guys will excuse me, and watched the guys hold hands and thought, I mean, wow. Like, that's another world. Didn't understand it, you know. I don't even think women were holding hands then. This sounds like it's in the dark ages. It was only 20 years ago. It wasn't that long ago, but it was another world. It really was another world. And I had one sponsor that I talked to after I drank all the time, and I knew I had to find another sponsor. And there was this really cute girl. And I love to tell this part of the story. She was the Irish kid that my mother didn't want me to bring home, you know. She had freckles, and she was wearing these silly galoshes at a meeting one day. It was really silly. She was wearing galoshes and had freckles and had a real cute smile. And I asked her if she wanted to play tennis. It was around now, in fact, 21 years ago. I think it was around March, right before Easter, 21 years ago. And I asked her if she wanted to play tennis, and she played horribly. It was really awful. She tripped when she tried to get a ball. I could beat her. But she was really, really cute. And I asked her to be my sponsor. And then this incredible thing happened. And I have to say, we're still together. I have to come to that part of the story real fast, because I went from a marriage to a relationship, and I've still had a very limited experience in my life. But this has been a 20-year relationship, and it's really incredible. Yeah. It can happen. You can do it. Keep the program first. Only advice. Got to keep the program first. At any rate, things got very, very, very hard at that point. We really did fall in love. It was the falling in love that I, you know, never, never had all my life. It was the coming to find out who I really am. It was extraordinarily. It was wonderful. It was painful. It was horrible. She had a marriage of 25 years at the time, 20 years or so, and four kids. And I had a marriage of 15 years and three kids. And there was a lot of pain there, as you can well imagine, and maybe some of you have gone through it, but it's very awful. We could not give each other up, and it was a praying and a struggling, and I truly believed in this program, and I truly believed in God by now, and I knew that I had to be me. And I knew that I couldn't go back to a marriage that wasn't me. And I prayed and went up to this place called Beech Hill in New Hampshire, just to get away for 3 days and to get some help. And I remember telling this priest, the first time, this Jewish kid talking to a priest, the whole thing didn't make sense to me. But I told him, and he said, falling in love. He said, it's like falling in love. When you fall in love, you fall, and you're out of control. And he gave me a name of a psychiatrist to see, just to talk to. And I called this man, this very dear man, saw me for 2.5 hours and didn't even charge me. And he told me some very wonderful things that I needed to hear. And he said, you know, I could have looked for 1,000 people and waited for the 1,001 person to get the answer, you know, that I wanted to hear. But I'm real grateful I heard it the first time. It's what I needed to hear. And when you know it's right in your heart. And there's no turning back, really. I guess there could have been, but there wasn't for me. And it's all about choices. But he said that if I went home, I would drink, and I would probably die. And I knew he was right about that. I could picture my kitchen table, and I could picture a bottle of scotch on the kitchen table. And it would have been Cutty Sark. You know, I can just even, I know that. And he said, if you live the life that you're choosing to live, you can be a much better mother. And I listened to that. I listened to that, and I knew he was right, and I prayed, and I asked for help. And finally, when I was 6 months sober, I heard at a meeting honesty, and I probably heard it 1,000 times, but I really heard the word honesty, and I knew that I couldn't sleep in the same bed with my husband any longer, and I knew I had to do something about my life. As it turned out, my partner, she had a harder time than I to make such a decision. And the two of us ended up making the decision independently of each other that we had to leave this marriage. Because if she changed her mind, I couldn't blame her, you know, vice versa. But it turned out she couldn't make this decision, and she ended up having not a breakdown really, but she just went blank. She could not make the decision. She couldn't function. And she ended up in a psych ward for 7 weeks and then did end up leaving. And after she had left the psych ward for 7 weeks and got an apartment, I left a week later. And I told the kids it was to find myself, but I could never go back. And in this, we both knew that it was better for the kids to be with their fathers. This was the most difficult part of it. We weren't capable of taking care of the kids. We certainly couldn't take care of 7 kids. We had no money. And we knew the kids would be better off staying with their fathers. So we made that decision. And it was probably the hardest decision I've ever made in my life. And then it took, we kept the program first, and the years did go by. I was very involved with AA. I got involved with working with women. We were able to start a halfway house. We put our whole lives into helping women, and I guess this was the way it was meant to be. People can't do that when they're married. They can do that when they're free. We were very, very deeply committed to giving back to the program. And we built an alcoholism treatment program, and it was very, very wonderful and very, very rewarding. And it took many years to get back a relationship with my kids. My daughter didn't talk to me for many years. I was 11 years sober when she got married the first time, and she wouldn't invite Sandy to the wedding. She finally did the day before, but, you know, a lot of pain. And I don't want to belittle the joy during the years of recovery, because there were some great and wonderful, wonderful things that happened in the years of recovery. And there was a lot of pain. And it was really about life. I guess it was life. And that you can go through anything staying sober. By the time my daughter married a second time, though, and that was, she got a divorce and married a second time, I think it was 6 years later, our closeness had already developed. I worked on it every day. I worked on it every day in trying to be there for the kids. And it was very, very painful. We left. We left the kids, you know. And it was very painful for them because they had lesbian mothers. And they were abandoned, and they had alcoholic mothers. So the kids went through an awful lot of stuff. And I did everything I could to just always be there for them. And at the end of 88, we left the alcoholism treatment program that we had been working for 14 years. It was time to stop. And somewhere before that, I got involved with meditation, and I got involved with really being who I am. And the more I asked for help, and the more that I just continued to ask for help for God's guidance in my life, I began being the writer that I always wanted to be, and I began to write some books, and it was very, very wonderful because I was able to really give of myself and become more and more of who I am. And I was able to have the opportunity to do a lot of speaking because my publisher said, "Do you speak?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Will you speak?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Will you call me in 2 weeks?" And I said, "No." And he called me in 3 weeks and said, you're on for speaking in Albany. I think this was in 87. And that started a lot of things that I was petrified of. I mean, I had been very, very shy, would never speak in public, and yet I believed in what I was doing. And I guess that's really, the point that I want to keep on saying is that Sue said something very profound, if you don't mind me sharing it, Sue. And we were talking before this morning, and I thought, I'd never heard anybody say this before. It was really profound. She said that fear has nothing to do with faith. We're always taught that faith is the fear is the lack of faith. Truth is, it's absolutely true. I could stand up here and be petrified, but I could still have faith that it's the right thing to do. You know, and I went around doing a lot of speaking on meditation things and really being very, very nervous. And still with all that stuff, I'm not good enough. And why would anybody want to hear me? Because all those other people really speak. You know, they know how to dress. They know what to wear. They know what to say. But I believed in my heart that this is what I was supposed to be doing, so I continued to do this. I've not put this part of the story outside, so if I'm jumbling around a little bit, forgive me. But while I was traveling, I heard at a conference once that I heard something about forgiveness, and I remember knowing that how could I be doing this public speaking because I hadn't forgiven my father. I had a lot of anger. I didn't say a lot of things earlier, but he and I fought a lot. The night before my mother died, he and I had a terrible fight in her hospital room. And he was 75 years old at the time, I think. And he stood at the elevator with me, and he shook his fist at me, and his face was red, and he said, "Get back to your people. Go back where you belong." And I was actually afraid of this man at that point still. He said, "I should hit you now like I didn't hit you when you were a kid." I had told my folks about my relationship. Obviously, I had left the kids. I had been very open and honest wherever I could be, but it wasn't. My folks couldn't handle it. They couldn't take it well. They did. My mother did the best she could with it, but she just couldn't. It was like too foreign to her. It was really like, what will the people think? The idea of people even thinking about what I was, that whole idea was just too much for her. But at any rate, I heard about forgiveness, and I had prayed a lot for forgiveness. I had heard forgiveness in this program. When I was here 4 years ago, I hadn't yet come to the place of forgiveness, but I had worked on it. I knew that it was a huge block between me and my sobriety, between me and my higher power. But after I traveled, we took a year and traveled around the country, and during that time, my father got very sick. And I prayed and prayed to be able to forgive him. And I went into the hospital room, and he said, "You haven't been around much lately." And I said, "No." And he said, "It's your fault, you know." And I said, "Yes." I was beyond arguing, and it really didn't matter. It was my fault that I hadn't seen him, but it was also my choice that I hadn't seen him. I saw him once a year on Father's Day, so I wouldn't feel guilty. But he said, "You know, I was nervous about your coming, but I want to tell you, I felt a rush." And I think that was the first time he ever shared a feeling with me. And I started to cry, and I knew none of the past mattered anymore. I knew that finally, after all the praying of letting go, that I finally had let go of my anger and my hate and my rage and everything that I felt against this man, which would take another hour to even tell you about, and I won't. But I'm sure if you have alcoholism in your home, you know what I'm talking about. I just had rage against him, and for what he did to my mother also. So that was 4 years ago. I hadn't had that yet when I spoke to you. I still had the rage, and that's over. And that's really to share, real important to share, because the program works and prayer works. And when we want something bad enough, all we have to do is have the intention. And it works. It's a miracle. And I still don't even know how, but we open ourselves up to the miracle of letting love come into our life. And I actually felt my heart shift. I actually felt my heart open. And I felt love for this man come in, and I couldn't believe it, because part of me says, "You still can't stand him, you know. But part of me, the deeper part of me, the spirit part of me, felt the love. And that man got sober. It is incredible. Not because he wanted to, but he finally stopped drinking because we had to put him in a nursing home. And he went to a nursing home. There was a we had a party for him when he was 90, and he got drunk and he broke an ankle, and lots happened. But he hasn't had a drink since, except when we took him out for Father's Day. And he asked for a scotch, and I let him have it, and I still can't say no. That's absurd, but I can't say no. He's 90. He was 92. Anyhow, that's a huge, huge change. And somewhere in here, my son had gotten very, very depressed. My son, four years ago, had gotten very depressed. My son was a very, very bright kid. Three majors in college, nothing like being a workaholic or an overachiever or anything. President of his fraternity, president of interfraternity council, and went on to work for a very large company in Pennsylvania where he had done so well. He was like the top of millions. I'm not really exaggerating. He was the top of all the new people coming in. And he had done so well that they were sending him back to Carnegie Mellon to get his master's, and they were paying for it. They were giving him a two-year leave of absence. But prior to this, he had gone into a deep depression. And he was suicidal at the time, and it came as a great shock because he was really the kid who was seemed to have his life together, really seemed to have his life together. My two daughters were not like him in that he was really eager to find out more about himself. He grew, he was wonderful with people. At any rate, he called me every morning for a while. This was about 3.5 years ago, and he couldn't get out of bed, and he was having a hard time. It was 5 a.m, and he'd call me and say, just talk to me. I had done some meditation tapes, and I had this voice that he liked to hear. He said, talk to me in your meditation voice. And I would tell him he could do it. You know, I would tell him the same stuff my father really, I guess, had told me. And he came back to, he took a leave of absence and came back to Boston and got some psychiatric help. And for the first time, really dealt with the stuff that was inside of him. He came to our place. We lived on the Cape at the time, and he came to my partner. For the years of being flip with her, ignoring her, not really ever having anything to do with her, and she apologized to him, and it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. And then he realized that he thought he had dealt with the fact that I'm a lesbian, because he had only told 4 people in 10 years. So he thought he didn't have to talk about it. He didn't have to deal with it. He thought he had dealt with it. But he really realized he hadn't. So he went back to Philadelphia, and he started to go to ACOA, and that was wonderful. He got into the program, and he did something very funny. I think this is wonderful. I'm glad I remembered to tell you about this, because it's neat. He would get up and say, I'm an adult child of, my name is Bob, I'm an adult child of an alcoholic, and my mother's a lesbian. And he came out for me all over Philadelphia. And I didn't mind. I still felt a little funny. I really didn't mind, because he was working on himself, and that was the most important thing. And he said after doing this about 10 times, he didn't have to do it anymore, because he figured he had told 400 people. And he had diffused it. And he really got into the program. He got into the program, and he overachiever again. He had notes up here. He would do everything perfect. He'd go to his computer and he'd copy the promises. He'd put everything into his computer. I mean, all the characteristics of an adult child, you know, he'd have in his computer. Perfectionist and overachiever. And then, and we were continuing to get closer. And he got engaged, and Sandy and I went down to visit him in August of 92. We went down to visit him, and he had a new apartment in Pittsburgh, and he was back in school, and he was pretty happy, and he was pretty high, thinking that school was easier than he thought it would be. He hadn't been in school. He was 29. He hadn't been in school since he graduated from regular college. But a very tragic thing happened, and this is real. I'm going to skip to that pretty fast. He called me one morning, October 12th of 92, and he was back in that state again, and he was crying on the phone. Said that he couldn't do it. He had finals coming up in 3 days. At Carnegie Mellon, they have 4 series of finals, not 2. They have a 6-week intensive program and then finals, and I guess this happens 4 times. And he was crying, and it was just like when he had called me 3 years prior to that. He said he couldn't do it. He's not going to make it. He can't... He can't study. He can't concentrate. He needed to get a B or an A in order for them to pay for his schooling. And he said he knows he's not going to do it. He can't do it. He can't make it. And he went on and on. And I really heard. I heard obsessive compulsive thinking in him. I said that to him. I said, you need to call a therapist. Maybe you need to get on pills. And I never told anybody to get on pills before, because I am one of the hardliners who do not believe in pills. I have changed. I do when you're in trouble. I absolutely believe in them when you're in trouble. But I said, maybe you need to get on pills. Call somebody. And he hadn't been going to ACOA a couple of months because he had moved to Pittsburgh and he hadn't gotten established in the new in his new area and his new meetings yet. And he said Michelle, his fiance, was looking for meetings for him. And I said, no, you look for him. You know, go to him. And he said he would. And we did some pretty powerful things together. I asked him if he'd get on his knees on the phone. And he said he's never done that yet. And he said he would. And he got on his knees. And I asked him if he would put down what he's afraid of in the God bag. And he said he would. And I told him I'd be home all day long. And I said, call me if you're in trouble. Call me. I'll be here for you all day long. And we talked for 45 minutes. And I felt good with the conversation. He said, I love you, Ma. And I said, I love you too, Bob. And I got a call that night that he had taken his life. And it was tough. And it was awful. And it still is. Because he was the kid who was doing the stuff, you know. He was the kid who was doing the work, which still doesn't make sense to me. And there's stuff I'll never know. And I guess the most important part of my being here to talk to you and to pass any any message that I have is that I knew right away, 7 days a week meetings. I knew it. I meditate anyhow, so I mean, that just, I kept on meditating. I had been with a therapist for the year before, because Sandy and I have been having some trouble around the kids. It was really around the kids. So thank God I was, because I called her right away, and she saw me 2 days a week and didn't charge for one of the days and charged half price for the other. She was incredible. And I did everything I know. I mean, thank God, 18 and a half years of sobriety at that time, I guess. And I knew what I had to do, and I knew I didn't want to die. It was not for me to die. I knew that. I didn't know what it was about, and I didn't know why, but I knew I had to put one foot in front of the other. And I remember I spoke at meetings. People would ask me to chair, and I talked. I even joined Compassionate Friends, which is I did it all, and I'm doing it all. And you do it to get through life a day at a time. And I remember looking at that book, Time for Joy. I came back and looked at that book, and I was really mad at myself because I said, it's not about joy. Life is not about joy. And how could I have ever put out a book that said Time for Joy? I really thought I have to write a retraction. That was my one of my first thoughts. But what I really came to know is what I really have come to know. And I have to tell you a little bit of a miracle. I don't understand a lot of things. I really don't understand God. I don't really understand spirituality. What I do know is that God has been there for me. What I do know is that God, my God did not change Bob's life, and my God did not make Bob do what Bob did, but Bob did what he did because Bob had to do what he did. I think in a moment of madness, I think in stress, he snapped. I really do. I think that it was a hormone imbalance. I didn't say one thing earlier when he had his first depression. I had written a poem because I had observed, it was something about my father sits in front of the TV, scotch in hand, watching the Kennedy assassination, tears running down his cheeks. This was years ago. My son sits in front of the computer, tears running down his cheeks, because he couldn't work. And then it was something about my own depression also, when I couldn't work and tears running down my cheeks. And I really got the connection of genes, and I really got the connection of chemical imbalance and depression. And my son didn't drink. And I truly think alcohol saved my life in the years of my depressions until I was ready to live without alcohol. But what I do understand out of all this is that when I ask for help, I get it. And that Bob had to make his own choices. And my therapist is saying, aren't you mad at God? Maybe you need to have this work through. And it's not a mad at God. God is a spirit. God is love. God is an energy in the universe that connects us all. My personal belief of my God only is that it's not a power moving us around like chess people on a chessboard, having this happen to this person and that to that. But my personal belief that I've come to in spirituality is that we can connect with this power, and that we can connect by asking and by opening. And then we make our choices, and we don't know the outcome. And Bob had tried. He got on his knees, I would say. You know, he got on his knees. He asked for help. When we went to his apartment later, he had written in his drawer, there was a little bag, and it said God bag. He had done it. He had done this thing. And inside the God bag, it said, it talked about his fears. He turned over his fear of failure, his fear of insecurity, and something else. He had done the stuff. How could he do it? These were my questions for so long. He did it because whatever happened just didn't work for him. What works for me didn't work for him. And I'll never know why, and I guess that's part of life too. But what I also know is that no matter what, I don't stop asking for help. And I don't stop believing in the program. And I don't stop knowing that the program works. And my brother told Sandy, my partner, why doesn't she take a pill? Why doesn't she take a tranquilizer? Make her feel better. She doesn't have to feel this. And what I knew again was a total reinforcement of everything that I've known all this time, that I had to feel what I had to feel so I could feel the joy again. And I was able to feel the love of my friends, and I was able to feel the love of my program, and I was able to be touched by the countless kindnesses that people did for me, you know. It was incredible. I mean, the kindness was the thing that touched me more than anything. And one pill or one cigarette or, well, drink, I know I would have been dead, but a pill would have maybe, you know, made me feel a little better, but I wouldn't have felt the depth. And I wouldn't have been able to, I'm saying get over it, I'm not over it, but I feel life again and I feel joy again. I remember one time I was feeling fantastic and I was feeling energized, and I thought, no, wait, you can't. Remember Bobby, you know, really. And then I gradually let myself come to life again because I had closed down, I had stopped. So I guess I'm here just to tell you, and I could probably talk for 1,000 hours, and I thought I wouldn't, I brought this book because there's something really fun in it, but that was only in case I couldn't talk for this amount of time. But what I'm here to say is that the programs all work, and the God works when we let God work in our lives, and that it is about love. It's about love, and it's about community, and it's about connection. And it's about being the best of who we are, and it's about following our dreams, and it's about finding out, it's about unblocking the stuff inside of us that keep us from being with each other, keep us from being with the depth of who we are, and keep us from being with our higher power. That's all. That's pretty simple, huh? God bless you all. Thank you.